Today on New Horizons, Bruce Barcott, author of The Last Flight of the Scarlet Macaw, One Woman's Fight to Save the World's Most Beautiful Bird.
Sharon herself is such an amazing person. You know, she wasn't just a tiger tamer in the traveling Mexican circus. She actually took that job in order to study mushrooms. You know, she really thinks nothing of putting on a pair of rubber boots and grabbing a machete and going out into the bush for days on end. But I found an amazing story of what one person really could do by just standing up and saying, you know, I think this is a bad idea. I'm gonna fight back against this.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. Sharon Mottola followed many paths before finding her life's calling. She was an Air Force survival specialist, an Iowa homemaker, and a tiger tamer in a traveling Mexican service before moving to a small Central American country of Belize. There, she opened a zoo populated by orphaned and injured native animals and earned the moniker the Zoo Lady. She also became embroiled in a battle to stop construction of a dam that would destroy pristine rainforest, including the nesting site of the country's last group of scarlet macaws, a large parrot known for its colorful plumage. Today's guest, Bruce Barcott, is the author of The Last Flight of the Scarlet Macaw, One Woman's Fight to Save the World's Most Beautiful Bird. The book, now available in paperback, was honored by Library Journal as one of the best books of 2008. It chronicles Sharon Mottola's crusade to prevent construction of the Xilijo Hydropower Dam in a remote area of Belize. Despite the efforts of Ms. Mottola and others, the dam was ultimately built and began operations in 2005. Bruce Barcott is the recipient of a 2009 Guggenheim Fellowship in Nonfiction. His work has appeared in Outside Magazine, National Geographic, The New York Times Magazine, Sports Illustrated, and other publications. His previous book, The Measure of a Mountain, Beauty and Terror on Mount Rainier, was a recipient of the Washington State Governor's Award. Today he joins us on the phone from Seattle. Bruce Barcott, welcome to New Horizons.
Thanks, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, how did a writer from Seattle, get involved in a story about a Belize zoo lady fighting a dam?
Good question. Well, I covered a lot of environmental issues for Outside Magazine back in the late 90s and early 2000s out of Seattle here. And so I was always on the lookout for good stories. I mean, in covering environmental issues for a magazine, you really have to look for those stories that embody larger issues. Just you know, writing a he said she said story about timber battles or salmon battles is fine for newspapers, but for magazines you need a real sort of epic story. And I heard about this little battle going on in Belize from a source of mine who he'd been a source for a couple of earlier stories. I call up folks, you know, I've worked with every now and then, just to get a sense of what they're working on. Hey, what's new? What's going on? What do you hear? And he said, well, we've got this really interesting thing going on down in Belize. So this company wants to put a dam up that would flood the nesting ground of the last band of scarlet macaws in the country. I said, oh, that's kind of interesting. You know, who's fighting it? And he says, well, there's this lady down there, and she's kind of the Dr. Doolittle of Belize. And, you know, as a reporter, those words perk up your ears.
That's
like,
right.
I'm like, tell me more. And, of course, I didn't know, you know, I knew very little about Belize. I was, you know, on the phone and fumbling for my atlas at the same time, you know, trying to figure out where Belize was. Of course, it's just south of Mexico and just directly east of Guatemala down in Central America. So that's kind of what got me started. You do a little research, you find out that an interesting thing is going on down there, and then you convince your editors to pop for a plane ticket to fly you down there, and that's how it got started.
Well, you know, I ran into a listener from one of our shows earlier just this last week, and he was saying that I've costed him a heavy price in books, because every time we have a show like this, he runs out and gets the book because of the fascinating discussion the author presents on the air. And I know you're going to present a fascinating discussion, but I've got to tell our listeners that this is definitely the book you want to read. There's no way in the next 25 minutes I can cover it all. And it's such a great story. Perhaps you should tell us a little bit. I mean, Belize is like the size of Massachusetts with 275,000 people. This is a really small place.
It is. It's an incredibly small place, and one of the reasons that I was attracted to the story that ultimately became the book is because it's such a small place. The size of Massachusetts, 275,000 people. You know, that's I compare that to the population of Corpus Christi, Texas. And I was just down at Corpus Christi about 3 weeks ago. Not a big place. but what that means is that as a writer, if you go down and spend time there, it's such a small country and so many people know each other that you actually can get a real sense of how the place actually works, how power operates, how the money shuffles around the country, comes in, goes out, this sort of thing. So that was one of the great attractions to me as a writer. But the story itself, I went down and checked out what was going on with the proposed dam. I was going in on a remote river in Belize, a place very few people had ever been. But one of the few people who had been there and knew what was there, specifically the nesting grounds of these scarlet macaws, was Sharon Matola, who ran this zoo. And she knew about it because she'd been back there doing field work on the scarlet macaws, watching how they nest and how their birds fledge and this sort of thing. And this was back in the late 90s. And she was a person who, you know, she has an incredible amount of passion for the animals of Belize, and she has sort of been on a one-woman crusade to educate the whole entire region about what is out there, what amazing animals are out there, from scarlet macaws to tapirs to howler monkeys, this sort of thing. And she essentially decided to put her foot down. She said, you know, we've been losing too many animals to development and dams and this sort of thing. And she said, you know, I'm gonna push back against this dam. And so she started writing letters about it and looking into it. And over the weeks and months and years, she essentially started attracting a following of people who said, you know, what Sharon's saying is right on. It's, you know, she's taking a brave stance against the power company and against the government, and she sort of started this crusade that attracted more and more people, and eventually became a real national issue in Belize. And she eventually ended up fighting the dam for about 5 years, from 99 to about 2004, maybe 2005 or so. And along the way, you know, she attracted a lot of enemies, a lot of powerful enemies in the government. They tried to essentially shut down her zoo, but that was the sort of thing that she had to deal with. Along with personal harassment and threats on her life and this sort of thing, but I found it an amazing story of what one person, you know, really could do by just standing up and saying, you know, I think this is a bad idea. I'm gonna fight back against this. And also Sharon herself is such an amazing person. You know, you mentioned some of her backstory. I mean, she was an expert in mycology and the study of mushrooms and fungi. And, you know, she wasn't just a tiger tamer in the traveling Mexican circus. She actually took that job in order to study mushrooms. She would do her act in the evenings around small towns in Mexico, and the next day she would go out and hunt mushrooms and find them, press them, and get back by 4 o'clock to do that night's show. So this was a person who, you know, as I say, as a writer, you run across these folks every once in a while in your lifetime, and I was lucky enough to be able to spend some years chronicling not only her battle, but her story as well.
One of the things about Sharon that I thought was so unusual that it may be the only thing in the book I thought, now wait a minute, did this really happen? And as I mentioned, she was a homemaker, but she left her husband in Iowa. She hops a freight train, as I understand it, as I remember it. That's really happened, did it?
It really happened. Freight trains heading east. She ended up in Florida. That's how she got down to Florida, was hopping of freight trains and ended up from Iowa down to Florida. She did that a couple of times, and that's just the sort of, you know, sort of slightly crazy, adventurous spirit that she has. I mean, you know, she down in Belize, she's lived there for 20, 25 years now, and, you know, she really thinks nothing of putting on a pair of rubber boots and grabbing a machete and going out into the bush for days on end. I mean, she usually schedules every year to a 2-week to 20-day scientific expedition into the backcountry where, you know, she and a number of scientists will get dropped in by helicopters, and they'll just drop them off for, you know, all, half a month to a month and leave them on their own, and they'll be out there surviving and you know, looking for new species of everything from mushrooms to plants to animals. But yeah, it really did happen. There was one story too that, you know, so many of those things with Sharon and the stories she can tell seem to, you know, lapse over into the realm of fantasy or the magical. But there was one story that she told, you know, when she was back there researching the scarlet macaws. It was about a young bird that had a broken wing. It had just fled from the nest and had a broken wing, so it couldn't fly. And it was sort of you know, easy pickings for a number of the predators who were in the area there. And but over the course of 24 hours, she and her research partner, a fellow named Greg Sho, decided to bring the bird in, and the parents of the bird essentially, you know, flew over Sharon a number of times, and there was a strange form of, you know, communication between the birds and Sharon about this little fledgling, and it was a positive message essentially. And I, you know, I heard her tell that story once or twice, and I was, you know, it's like, oh, that's a great story. You know, did that really happen? I don't know. You know, it seems a little far fetched. But then one day, weeks later, I was going through some boxes full of documents and paperwork that Sharon has kind of strewn about her office down there. And I came across the field notebook of Greg Sho. And in Greg's notes, you know, nobody was pressing this on me or anything. In Greg's notes, I found his writings about that day. And it was essentially exactly as Sharon had related it to me. So I had corroborating independent evidence, and I was able to put it into the book. But that's the sort of thing that happens in Sharon's life.
When you described visiting Sharon in her home there on the zoo property, there was a jaguar walking around, and I couldn't determine whether this is a jaguar that was protected from her by fence or whether there was actually one that was acting more like a house cat than a wild animal.
No, it is actually there is a chicken wire fence between Sharon and Angel, who's the jaguar. It's a three-legged jaguar. It was injured out in the bush. She brought it in. But it's a, if you can imagine, you know, the old habitrail gerbil habitats,
right,
it's a sort of a habitrail-like thing that comes into Sharon's office, and it shares like a quarter of Sharon's office, but it's fenced with some chicken wire. That's essentially because she says, you know, in talking with her about Angel and other jaguars, she says, you know, you'll see tiger acts in the circus and lion acts in the circus. She says, you'll never see a jaguar act in the circus. She says, because you can't tame them really. You can't train them. It's they really are wild animals to the core. And so it's, Angel comes up into her office, but there is some separation there. And, you know, Sharon told me a number of times, you know, do not ever feed the jaguar with your hand unless you want to feed it your finger.
Well, let's talk about the dam, the controversy that Sharon's so famous for, opposing the dam, of course. Why did she decide to get involved? Maybe you can describe the valley that was involved here, because this dam's going to come in and flood this valley.
Sure.
That is very ecologically distinct.
Sure. It's an amazing valley. It's a fairly untouched. There were really no roads into the valley. When I went up to see the valley with Sharon years ago, it was a 2 to 3 day canoe trip to get into the area. And it's sort of a safe haven for a lot of the wildlife in the area during the dry season down there, when a lot of the food supply dries up around the region. This valley sort of remains lush because of the flooding action of the river. It remains a little damp, and there's plenty to eat, so a lot of animals retreat to this valley to survive the dry season. And for the scarlet macaws, the valley is especially important because the action of the river in flooding every year knocks down lower branches of a lot of the trees, and eventually those scarred areas where the branches were knocked out become nest hollows that scarlet macaws use to nest. And as Sharon said, Scarlett McCaws, you know, don't need just trees to nest. They need these trees that are essentially customized for them by the dynamic action of the river. So that was why the macaws nested in that area on the McCall River. And the problem with the dam wasn't exactly black and white, which was one of the reasons I really liked this issue. It wasn't just done for sheer profit. Belize actually, you know, did and still does need power. They have few options in terms of how they're going to generate electricity. And rivers are one thing that they have, and so what they did was essentially they sold their power company to a company up in Canada that knew how to build small dams, and the power company came down and said, "Oh, we know how to build a small dam. We'll do it right here." But they really didn't take into account the scarlet macaws or other animals in the area. So they and the government sort of agreed to put up this dam. It was a dam about 100, 150 feet high, and it was going to produce, you know, a little amount of power, a lot for Belize, but not anything on the order of the Grand Coulee Dam or anything like that.
What is six megawatts of power? I mean, what could that do?
Well, it was 6 megawatts. Is, you know, you can get 5 megawatts out of a very big wind turbine today. 6 megawatts is, you know, in America, let's say 5,000 houses. But for Belize, it's a fair chunk of their electrical supply.
So it is a big deal for Belize, even though it might not sound much to those of us up this way.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So and in Belize, you know, you do have to give them their due in terms of them being, you know, a really small country, and a lot of people on both sides of this issue, you know, were doing their best to try to solve this problem, which was, like I say, one of the reasons I really enjoyed working on it. It wasn't just, you know, bad guys on one side, good guys on the other side. There was some real complexity to it, and in a way, it was, like I say, a microcosm of a lot of the issues that people face around the world in terms of energy and the environment. You know, how much is enough to give up, and how much is too much to lose in terms of birds and you know, tapirs and other animals.
But there were a lot of guys that acted like bad guys. I mean, even though
there were. The government in power at the time, it was one of these governments that came in with a lot of high hopes, and, you know, a year or two into office, they were really just stealing the country blind. I mean, the corruption involved was on a scale that Belize had never seen before. Belize is a fairly, very peaceful and fairly clean country as corruption goes, but this government came in and they were just taking money right and left. And this was one of the ways that they operated. There were a lot of secret contracts that were signed that nobody ever knew about between the government and the company building the dam that ultimately came to light. But the way they operated, it really didn't give Sharon much of a fighting chance. And even though it didn't give her much of a fighting chance, she still came within a single vote of stopping that dam.
That was the British agency that was one vote. Was it one vote away?
Yeah, the case ultimately became a legal battle, and it went to the highest court in the British Commonwealth. Belize is a former British colony, and as a former British colony, some of their toughest cases, they often refer to the Privy Council in London, which is essentially a Supreme Court for former colonies that they can use. So this entire battle over this tiny little dam in Belize ended up being decided in a tiny courtroom next to Nine Downing Street, next to the British Prime Minister's office there. And essentially you have 5 members of the House of Lords in England sitting there hearing arguments on both sides from people in Belize. It was an amazing scene. I actually flew over to be there for the court hearing. And you have people in the black robes and the wigs and everything going on. And ultimately it was decided by a vote of 3-2. It was a single vote that let the dam go through.
You're listening to Bruce Barcott. He is the author of The Last Flight of the Scarlet Macaw, One Woman's Fight to Save the World's Most Beautiful Bird. Well, you know, Bruce, if there's one organization I could hope to count on if I got into a battle trying to save the Scarlet Macaw, it would be the Belize Audubon Society. Didn't work out that way, did it?
It didn't. This was one of the funny bizarre aspects of this. It took me a while to figure this out because I went down there, and when I went down there in 2002, Sharon had already been fighting this battle for 2 to 3 years. And one of the strange things was the Belize Audubon Society was actually against Sharon. They were on the side of the dam, and I couldn't figure this out. I said, you know, what's going on here? Well, the deal is that years earlier, the Belize Audubon Society had signed an agreement with the Belizean government to essentially run Belize's national parks, which had, for the most part, worked out really well for both sides. The Audubon Society, as a nonprofit, was able to sustain itself and run the country's national parks fairly well. And the government didn't have to spend its limited resources on a whole national park service. But the problem then became that the Belize Audubon Society had the name of the Audubon Society that we all know and love and everything, but it really was an arm of the government because the government controlled a lot of its power in terms of the national parks. So what would happen then would be that Sharon would talk about this battle to folks from outside Belize, and folks from outside Belize would look at this and say, well, the Audubon Society is for the dam. What's the problem? And it would become a real challenge for Sharon to try to explain, well, the Audubon Society that you know up there in the U.S. isn't the same as the Audubon Society down here in Belize. So the complexities of Belizean politics really played a big role in the whole battle, and it was a difficult one to fight for that reason, and also because of the endangered species status of the scarlet macaw.
And didn't the company hire a very respected and authentic biologist who created an environmental impact statement that didn't do the company any good, questioned the whole project? How'd they get around that?
This was incredible. This was one of the dynamics that goes on if you're a reporter for a newspaper that you learn over the years is that your time and space are very limited when you write articles about issues like this. And often, a corporation that's building a project like this understands that and can take advantage of that. And one of the ways they do that is by putting out environmental impact statements. This is, a study of what the dam would do to the surrounding environment. And the environmental impact statement that they put out on Chileo was a very impressive document. It was 1,500 pages long. It's one of the biggest documents ever produced in Belize. So reporters would go down there and they'd take a quick glance at this 1,500-page document. Nobody ever read it. No reporter has the time. But what you do read as a reporter is you read the executive summary, which is about a 3-page statement of what's in the 1,500-page document. So you read the summary, and the summary says, they say that there'll be a little bit of an impact on the birds and a little bit of impact on the tapirs and the monkeys, but overall it won't be that bad. Well, then, if you actually take the time to go back and read through the data and all the evidence that's in the 1,500-page report, you see that, well, the data and evidence actually say the exact opposite of what's in the executive summary. And this is, this is fairly typical play for a company that wants to sort of greenwash a project like this. But, only if you're sort of a crazed book writer and have the time to sit down and read through the entire report do you find that that's what's going on. The data, directly contradicted what was in the executive summary. And that's how often these things, they get away with it.
And there was also a serious question about the stability of the rock foundation upon which the dam was to be built. And I know when you described the dam, when it finally did clear all these hurdles that were placed in front of it, it dog-legged, which I think you were intimating might have been to get around some soil issues. Do you have any concern today about whether that dam's going to make it next earthquake?
There is some concern. This was early on. One of Sharon's supporters was a reluctant geologist named Brian Holland, and Brian was a fellow who didn't consider himself an environmentalist. In fact, he ran a small mining operation down south of the country. But he happened to read the geology report on the dam, on the proposed dam, and what he read in the report contradicted everything that he knew about that site. He'd actually been up there sort of checking out the area years earlier. Because the dam company said, look, what we've got here at the site is good, solid granite. We're going to put up a dam. It's going to have a good, solid granite foundation. No problem. Well, Brian had been there, and he said, you know, there's no granite in that area. There's none at all. It's all sandstone. And the thing about dams is you can build a dam on sandstone. That's not a problem. But you have to know that it's sandstone. You have to account for that in how you design the dam. So that, you know, this was another way that Sharon gained supporters over the years, was Brian came on, and his concern wasn't so much the wildlife or the birds, but it was the people downstream of the dam. He said, you know, as a geologist, if I don't say anything, I'm essentially, you know, it's my duty to speak up and say we need to know what's going on here. So in the end, when the dam was built, I went out to see it, and you know, the original plans for the dam called for a nice, slightly curved dam, almost straight across the river. And I went over and saw it, and darn if there wasn't a kink in the dam. I mean, it went straight for a while, and then there was a dog leg right, like it was a, you know, the third hole on a golf course or something. And I talked to one of the engineers who had been actually working on the dam. He said, "Oh yeah, we had to kind of move it over a little that way because we were looking for some solid ground to put it on, and that was where we found it."
Unbelievable. Now you said in your book that the real danger as far as the scarlet macaws are concerned is that they wouldn't. I mean, you weren't saying this, but you were gathering this from the people who were advocating, people like Sharon, that they wouldn't be able to relocate, that they wouldn't move up onto higher ground. And, of course, there's jaguars, there's tapirs involved here. It's now 5 years later, and I'm just about running out of time here, so I just want to get the verdict, so to speak. How wrong or right was Sharon?
The verdict is we still don't know. The adult birds are still there. They're still there roosting and feeding in the area. Nobody knows whether they're actually having chicks in the area. It's tough to get in there. The power company now controls most of the area around the dam, and so you can't go into the area without their permission. And they agreed when they put the dam up to monitor the area and let everybody know what was going on. Well, they hired somebody for a year, and then they quietly let them go. So really, nobody's up there monitoring the area. People are, you know, here and there keeping their eyes out for baby scarlet macaws, essentially. But we don't know and won't know until the power company starts letting people into the area. So it's a big black box at this point.
You know, I'm always curious about what impact a book like yours has on the country it's written about, on, in this case, ecotourism, on the reaction of the local, the governing folks in Belize. I mean, you didn't exactly write a Chamber of Commerce guide to Belize City, especially in the beginning. You pointed out that it's a pretty dangerous place to hang out. Did you catch any grief from Belize officials, or are you welcome back in Belize these days?
You know, it's funny, actually, a few weeks after the book came out, the government, the very, you know, corrupt government that was in power, was voted out by the people. Not,
well, there you go.
Believe me, not due to my book. So that took a little of the heat off of me. Actually, I've gotten some great reaction from a lot of Belizeans who are you know, happy to see their country not portrayed in a poor light, but portrayed honestly. You know, I was very conscious of being respectful of Belize and Belizeans in writing this book, because to me it was the spirit down there of the people is kind of a lot like the spirit of, say, Alaskans in the 50s or 60s or 70s. It's a real pioneering place, and there's a lot of ingenuity in terms of people figuring out how to make a living down there. So that part of it is played up as well in the book, but no, I didn't fear for my safety at all after the book came out, thankfully.
Well, Bruce, we've run out of time, but I really want to thank you for being on the show, but also, more importantly, for writing the book. I don't say this at the end of all of these interviews I do, but this is definitely a book that I know our listeners are going to enjoy as much as I did. Get out and get a copy of it, The Last Flight of the Scarlet Macaw, One Woman's Fight to Save the World's Most Beautiful Bird. Bruce Barcott, thank you for joining us today on New Horizons.
Thank you, Bob.
Next week, Larry Tye, author of Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons.